Between 1997 and 2014, Tom Christensen won the world's toughest motor race, the Le Mans 24 Hours, a record 9 times, and finished on the podium on 5 more occasions. Every time his car made it to the finish, it was in fact in the top 3. It's no wonder that he is the greatest sports car driver known as Mr. Le Mans to motor fans around the world. It's the title of his new autobiography, Mr. Le Mans. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from Denmark, Tom Christensen. Tom, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. That was a very long intro.
Well, you know, we like to sort of build up because you are Mr. Le Mans. What's it like having that title? I mean, it is the world's most famous motor race.
Yeah, it has been my dream when I was a small kid, when I was doing go-kart. It was my dream to compete at Le Mans with my team and co-drivers at one stage. And absolutely. It has been a great journey racing at the tough track during night and day, or sometimes we had rain, sometimes we had heat, and yes, sometimes at night with the fog, it was tough to see or find the opponent.
So tell me a little bit about how, because your website said you grew up in a garage. I mean, are you from a mechanical family? Were your parents into racing? I mean, you started in go-karts.
Yeah, my dad was racing at a bit of amateur, like touring cars. He was actually going abroad to the UK and taking part in these hot rod championships as well. He did Paris-Dakar a couple of times, mainly in a truck. But basically, when I grew up on that gas station, there was people and passion in the evening around cars where they were honing, they were tuning, they were preparing themselves for the local races. And yes, I'm homeborn on that gas station, and for sure that environment that clicked from the beginning. I started doing karting when I was 8-9 years old. In the first 2 or 3 years, it was very little, and then it just got more and more.
And you got into Formula 3. You won the European Championship in Formula 3, highly competitive. And then you went to Japan, and that must have been a culture shock. And B, what was the racing culture like over there?
The racing culture was great. It's amazing. So many circuits there, and imagine how many Japanese companies and people involved. Kind of the car industry. That was the same for the motorsport. So it was. Was huge, and but the culture was definitely a shock in terms of the. I mean, based on a different religion, everything the whole way they in kind of they treat you certainly with respect, but with a language barrier. Initially, it was very tough. It was tough to get around. All the signs going around in the streets were in kanji or hiragana, or of course Japanese in that sense. So it was very difficult in the beginning, and not many people at that time when I was there in the early 90s were speaking so good English. And actually my English became worse when I was there. Just tried to simplify it.
And what was it like racing? I mean, it's Formula 3000. It was Formula Nippon, and I suppose you'd call it GP2 now, wouldn't you? The one beneath Formula 1.
Yeah, you even call it F2 now to the last couple of years. That was more or less the. And in Japan, there was just a little bit more competition. So there was the tires were free. So the teams were supported by different tire manufacturers. So as you know, in racing, the tires are in a way the black gold, because when they start to compete and putting you on softer rubber, specialized rubber, lap times were just going down, and we were doing very, very fast lap times around Suzuka. So if you could compare, that means that we were doing lap times which sometimes could bring us close or even into the top 10 of Formula 1 races due to the fact that we have these tire companies investing money into the Formula Nippon, as you correctly said. So it was a great time, and there was many foreign drivers competing with the local Japanese over the years and back then, some from former Formula One and some went into Formula One from there. And my own destiny became then towards sports cars and Le Mans, American Le Mans series, and the sports car races, WEC, what it's now called. So, yes, a long journey, a long time, and I certainly enjoyed my time also in Japan.
Audi has been a vital part of your success. You originally got involved with him with DTM, which is, you know, perhaps the best touring car championship in the world, of course, the German Touring Car Championship.
Yeah, it's very, very incredibly competitive. It starts with, you know, the board members rubbing shoulders from the different manufacturers, and then we go very hard on it and into the racing around mainland Europe, basically. Sometimes in Spain, sometimes in Italy, sometimes in the UK, and Holland and France. But normally half of the races are done on the famous circuits in Germany.
1997 comes along, and you get your first drive at Le Mans, and it's going to be it is quite a drive indeed. What's it like? Because, you know, as you said, you grew up with a dream of racing at Le Mans, you know, when you were karting. And what's it like when you actually sort of, you know, get into the pits, get into the car, and then drive under the Dunlop Bridge for that first time?
That was incredibly special. I mean, it came as a surprise. I was just called literally 4 days before the event when I was leading the Formula 3000. So it was amazing just turning up what I had been dreaming of when I was younger. But it caught me by surprise. I entered there, and then you get this feeling you sometimes know that you really have to perform. You get your chances in life, and this was one of the very big chances. So when I drove out through the Dunlop chicane under the Dunlop Bridge, it was important not to do any mistakes. But at the same time, there was very high pressure on you had to perform very early on in a short stage. Otherwise, this opportunity would just end.
And coming onto the Mall Sound straight for the first time, that must be a memorable experience as well, as you opened the car up.
Yeah, I didn't exactly. I absolutely. But it's to get the flow. I was partnered with Michele Alboreto and Stefan Johansson, and they were very experienced, of course, coming from Formula One. And in that sense, it was great getting the camaraderie from these elder personnages, also including in the little Jurst team. There was only like 12 mechanics, and they were all sort of helping the young man in. But I had to perform straight away, and with this atmosphere and the way they treated me, that was possible. But certainly, what is the key is to be good when you're driving into the sunset, when you are getting completely blinded by the sun, and then shortly after, it's dark anyway because it's night.
And I mean, one of the special characteristics of Le Mans is the speed differential. And you could say there are quote unquote gentleman drivers next to the professionals that, you know, that you are. And it must be quite difficult in the sunset or when dawn's coming up or at night to judge the distances. And you know, and your nighttime drive in 97 impressed a lot of people.
Yeah, it's very you have to be in very, very alert at all the times. I mean, you're driving the LFP cars, the fastest cars, and where the issue really getting sometimes nail biting, that's when you are getting into top gear and you're approaching the braking points. When a GT car is maybe doing 300 kilometers an hour, we are approaching like 340 kilometers an hour. And they, because of their weight, they have to start braking probably 20 meters before us. So at that point, when they start to brake, they're getting down to 270, 260, 250. And there, the difference is sometimes up to around 100 kilometers. And that's where you really have to make sure that you don't have an let's say, a contact which could lead to something worse. So when you're setting up, coming up for the breaking point, that's where you have to be incredibly accurate in that sense. And people are sometimes questioning at night. It must be difficult when people see you when they're coming up at night. But actually at night, the headlights on the cars are kind of warning that you know that somebody is coming up behind you with a certain speed. And then it's normally the rule that the cars which we overtake will sort of stay in the line and keep the line. But unfortunately, it's always practically that way. And as they are, of course, having their own race, they are trying to get away from their opponent themselves and doing fast lap times. And it's in this universe where a lot of things happening and where you are incredibly focused. And that's what racing is in a way. It's most tense in all the years I've done racing. That is racing at night. And as you correctly said, there are actually up to four categories there is these days.
And I mean, when you think about, you know, they call it sports car racing or endurance racing, if you like. But if you see the onboard footage as we can do these days and follow Le Mans 24 hours during the race, you know, the difference of speed. I mean, a Grand Prix is a sprint race. It's like once around the track compared to what you guys do. How do you keep your concentration for those? What are you doing? 3 hour stints, 2 hour, 4 hour stints when you've got your two other teammates?
Yes, you are allowed maximum of 4 hours in one go. You normally would triple stint or maybe four times stint the tires, and then you would change to your teammate. But basically, it's Le Mans. The approach is not you have to win every corner. The approach is you have to get your stint as fast as possible. So if you lose a little bit on entry to a chicane, it's very good that you then, with the traffic in front of you, make sure that you have a superb exit of that chicane, so leading onto the next straight. So it's always with the traffic on hand to make sure that you cover the fastest distance and longest distance and thinking a little bit ahead. It's not about how fast you can overtake them, and then maybe you breaking the car down, you win the corner, but you're losing so much momentum that by passing a car into a corner or chicane, you actually lose more momentum until the next. So it's all about reading the traffic. It's about, let's say, cutting the butter smooth and making sure that you are in the rhythm. I can only tell you, when you get into that racing car, you hear on the radio, come on, go, 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 green, green, green. And you're leaving the pit lane and you hear the engine and you're accelerating and you're looking for the apex of the corners. You are not worried about anything else than the concentration is absolutely there, 100%. The adrenaline, the focus, you don't think of anything else about doing the best you can with the car you have underneath you.
Cutting the butter, I like that. I like that a lot. And you won that Le Mans in a privateer Porsche against the factory Porsches, an incredible achievement.
Yeah, it was good. It was a very good time, and for me at the... Well, it's a fantastic debut. We were coming a little bit from behind, but we were going incredibly well, putting a lot of pressure on the BMW and the works Porsches, the Nissans. We had overtaken quite early, and in that sense, we just yelled, and I felt accepted with the team. I felt the teammates were rooting for me. I felt my teammates would like me to be in the car. And then all at once, I suddenly had done fastest lap, which even became later the lap record. And a debut like that is, of course, something which proved kind of a way of a destiny. It's certainly the race which has taken and also given the most for my career. So in that sense, it's a race which has been there many years. The first race was 1923. I didn't watch that one, but having said that, that's in a couple of years. That race has its 100 years anniversary, and by the time I retired, for having won 10% of the races was something which was something I could only dream of and which I actually did when I was a child, but that was just the racing there.
I mean, when you think of Le Mans and you think of the names that have won it and the thing and the names that you sort of associate with Le Mans, Jackie Ickx, Derek Bell, etc., and you know, the greats, and then you got the Audi R8, which was a superb car. I mean, what was it like when you first saw the R8? Did you know it was going to be such a complete package?
Yeah, the R8, which now is a name which everyone who drives an Audi knows, because it became the name of their sports car later because of our success at Le Mans. But actually, that was this car was instrumental in me giving the handshake to Dr. Ulrich, who was the Audi Sport boss at the time, and of course, huge successful over many, many years. I visited him in Ingolstadt in Germany at the Audi Sport headquarters. It was very humble back then. And it was in November 1999. And he showed me the drawings of the Audi R8. And I said, oh, I would very much like to be part of that team. And I switched from BMW to Audi within 20 minutes.
And it was. I mean, it was a fantastic car, and there was a fantastic team built around it. Tell me a little bit about because you mentioned that like 1920s when Le Mans started, and for Brits, of course, that means one name and one name only. That means Bentley and the supercharged the 2.5 liter blowers. What was it like getting into a Bentley and winning in a Bentley as well?
That was great. It was reigniting all that. Bentley boys, all that, the epoch about the great Bentley boys, what they did, driving down from the UK. Bentley was, in fact, the very first international car manufacturer to compete at Le Mans. They were there in 1923 doing the fastest lap, not winning. I think they came fourth. But 1924 was the first win of Bentley, and then they did, of course, these until the early 30s, they had five wins. And celebrating when they drove back at the Savoy Hotel in London. All these things with Wolf Bernardo, of course, one of the legendary drivers at that time. This was certainly great to reignite that and driving for Bentley. And actually also at times I had the chance to drive these old Bentley blowers for exhibition, even at a circuit, even at Le Mans, even in Tivoli and Copenhagen. So it was a great honor to reignite that, and also for a Dane to feel a little bit British just for half a year. That was certainly something worth remembering.
And of course, it's not just about, I mean, the book's called Mr. Le Mans, but it's not just about Le Mans, it's about Sebring as well, because you've had spectacular success there.
Yeah, Sebring, I love the city in southern Florida. It's a very, it's like now we are in, I mean, people are watching a lot of cycling at the moment, but it was like the Paris-Roubaix of motorsport in that way. It's a very uneven surface, incredibly bumpy. In Sebring, it's an old military airport, which then has created so many races for, as you say, the drivers you mentioned before, Fangio, Andretti, added to the ones were competing in the early days, and we are still having some great races in Sebring. But in generally, I've raced all around the globe, so there's much more to it than that. I'm happy you mentioned that, because racing has certainly been my life. But it's true that the most success I've had at these sports car races, which I'm incredibly grateful to my teams and the teammates I have been around during those years.
And of course, you became, I mean, basically became Denmark's most famous person. I mean, you're equivalent of a knight, I believe. Is it? Should I be addressing you as Sir Tom Christensen?
Yeah, but I will not call me the most famous Dane. Absolutely not. I live in a small city called Hobro. Yes, the spring has arrived here at Easter. Denmark is kind of that small that you know we're even playing some soccer games these days, and we all have to to sort of support in many ways. We are not so many that that sometimes we are having to sit on the bench on the national soccer team. Sometimes we have to help the politicians a little bit. You cannot just have one job in Denmark because we are so small. But to call me one of the most famous, that's certainly not right. The royalty here, they get that bonus, and the politicians as well. We sports people, we absolutely love our sport and love sport in generally. And I'm just happy to have contributed, and I look forward to help more talent, particularly in racing, but from all around the world. That's where my passion is.
And what was it like putting this book together and you know, going through the memories and visiting the highlights and the lowlights, of course, you know, the low points?
It's fascinating. It was quite, it took some years now after I retired, but still to do it was quite important and very nice. After my retirement, it was kind of easy. It was certainly not something you like to do when you are racing, because there's the focus and you don't want to divert away from that. You didn't want to go back and look and say and speak and think about things which you already left behind you. But when you obviously you're doing a biography, you have to revisit all these things. And it was very important to put a book out which was love for the sport, love for my family, love for my parents, who unfortunately not are here anymore. This is all part of me, all a part of the journey. And having been doing that, it was nice to do the last chapter. And I would say it was kind of easy, even though it took a long time. The difficult part was to find pictures and to leave pictures photos out of the book. That was difficult.
Is there a favorite memory of Le Mans? Do you have a favorite Le Mans where you stood on the podium, or maybe you didn't stay at the podium? Maybe you were somewhere down the field or something. Or what was your favorite memory of? Is it the first one? Is it the ninth one? Is it the Bentley one? Is it is it the first one in the R8? What was perhaps a highlight at Le Mans?
Yeah, for me, every year was, I did 18 starts at Le Mans. Every year was very special. People from the outside, a lot of people within the sport have mentioned the 2008 to be the best Le Mans ever for many, many reasons. And one of them was the extreme fight against our car, number two, and the Peugeot. They were high favorites that year. They had won Sebring earlier that year, and we had this immense fight where everyone was doing well. I was partnered with Alan McNish, the Scotsman, and Dindo Capello from Italy, and these are also the two teammates I have been driving with for the let's say the most of my sports car career. So we were a very good team, and I would say that race we delivered something unique in combination, and with the rain which arrived I think five or six times throughout the race, it was sort of coming and going, and when the circuit dried up we were getting smacked, but when the rain came in we had the upper hand of advantage. So the lead changes were a lot, so the adrenaline always high, the risk always incredibly high. We took chances that you, in a way, when you think back, you would say that was not possible. But we knew, and we had looked eye to eye within the team, within the teammates, and saying we have to go flat out if we are to have any chance of winning. And then, it was unexpected, absolutely unexpectedly happened, and we won the race.
The book is called Mr. Le Mans, Tom Christensen. It's by Tom Christensen with Dan Philipson. It's out now on Evro Publishing. Tom, if people want to find you, I know there's a website. Where can they find you?
Yeah, I have a website, tomchristensen.com. But I mean, I think nowadays like my children have helped me update my Instagram account, which has the same name, tomchristensen_com. Probably there is where you get closest. But I hope they will take time, read the book, and make sure they will watch Le Mans 24 Hours again this year, which will be in August, where I will have my my feet up on the sofa, and I will be watching and cheering for the winner.
You see, this is the thing I was going to ask you, Tom, because, you know, you are Mr. Le Mans, 9 times winner, and there are some great names. Alan McNish, of course, a great racer, Jackie Ickx, Derek Bell, etc.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And then you know, just when they go down the Mulsanne, or when they go through down to Arnage, do you not think, ooh, maybe just one more time?
Yeah. Certainly, sometimes I think that, and also it was probably more difficult in the early years when I was there. I have been at Le Mans every year after I retired, apart from last year due to the COVID. But when I'm there, I sometimes take myself of having exactly those well described feelings you just said, and then I sort of put myself in the car in the race. And then I go back and have an espresso. It's, that's a good thing about it. But I certainly think the race from inside out. Sometimes I commentate with Eurosport. Sometimes I commentate here in Denmark with Formula One. And at these times, I really try to put myself into the into the driver's head, into the drivers, how they. I try to understand it that way. So. I would say it even gives me, as a retired racer, watching racing today, the insight you have of having competing over so many years. At least it gives you the idea that you actually know 100% how they feel and what they are doing and what they are seeing. And then I get a big adrenaline kick from their experiences too.
Well, hopefully we'll see crowds at Le Mans at some point soon. All things, if not this year, then hopefully next year, because the atmosphere is amazing. This book is called Mr. Le Mans. It's by Tom Christensen. Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you for your time, and all the best to all your listeners.